Here's Broadside, Civil Rights on the Streets, and In Your Face, 2.5 hours of talk, interviews, music, and the occasional rant, perhaps the frequent rant, from me. I'm your host, Baffert Pierre Robert Norris. Stay with us. Today is December 30th, 2001. This is our last show of the year. Be a part of it. Sunday morning. Phone number here in case you wish to join this Civil Rights on the Streets show, and that's what we're all about. Right of people to survive who happen to be poor, who happen to be homeless, who happen to be outside or struggling just barely on the inside, or who are supportive of those struggles. That's what the show focuses on. We spend a lot of time on crazy laws like the silly municipal code sleeping ban section of the camping ordinance, or the entire camping ordinance and its criminalization of poor people for simply trying to shelter themselves. And we place a lot of emphasis on holding local politicians responsible for their failure to deal with these issues, for making commitments and breaking them, for failing to adhere to the party platform that they have, in essence, been a part of, as, for example, Councilmember Fitzmaurice has done with his Green Party membership, but yet, though he's a Green Party member and the Green Party platform says no sleeping bans and laws against the homeless, he has continued to support our own Santa Cruz 11 a.m. to 8:30 p.m., sorry, 11 p.m. to 8:30 a.m. sleeping ban, which affects 1,000 to 2,000 people every night outside. And we hope to get you involved and hope to get you to make phone calls, join protests, support folks like those people in Camp Paradise, which is currently, configuring itself out at New Brighton Beach and working at its headquarters at Coral and River Street downtown. Headquarters actually being the headquarters of the Santa Cruz Service Corps, but it's staffed by a lot of Camp Paradise people. If you want to get in touch with those folks, we will have the phone numbers for you, and encourage you also to talk about your own experiences on the streets. Important to let people know that they're not alone, and it's important for you out there when you've been hassled by a police officer, when you've been messed with by a merchant, when you've been ignored by a city council authority, when you've been trying to get some legitimate attention for an issue that has been needing attention, been ignored for a long time. It's important for you to know that you're not alone out there, and that's what this show is about, bringing people together so that people can be aware that it's not just one voice ranting in the wilderness, but it's a real condition that affects hundreds and thousands, if not thousands, of people here in Santa Cruz. Certainly hundreds of people are homeless. Actually, estimate 1,000 to 2,000 in the city, 6,000 to 10,000 in the county. But, of course, more than that, face the threat of homelessness, face the reality of no rent controls or no just eviction and no just eviction ordinance, and the reality that council members are doing nothing about this, including our latest council member mayor, Christopher Crone, who has been invited to call into this show and still is, and perhaps he's listening in. Who knows? If he is, he's welcome to call in. It's been suggested to me that I should be nicer to this guy and try to get on his right side, his bright side, his sunny side, and give him credit for all the good things he's done. Well, I certainly want to give people credit for the good things they've done. When you're in a position of power and you do so many bad things, and you ignore so many bad things and let them continue, and they're brought to your attention repeatedly, and then you move to repress people who bring them into that particular sphere of attention, it seems kind of counterproductive and Pollyannish. I don't know what the word is. Looking at the world through rose-colored glasses, futile, perhaps the word is, to not bring the issues squarely forward. And so, while I'm not trying to be personal with Mayor Crone, I think it's important that he address issues that he has failed to address. And, of course, the most obvious issues as we look outside in the rain and the cold over this Christmas, holiday, New Year's season is his utter failure to do anything about the civil rights of homeless people in the winter, about the completely inadequate shelter situation in the winter, which he has known about because he sat on the task force to examine the camping ordinance for 3 months and attended dozens of hours of hearings on this issue, and then he was instrumental in creating the Homeless Issues Task Force, whose recommendations he and his city council ignored completely, except to give another police job to homeless resource officer Eric Seeley, who has gotten mixed reviews in that position, and certainly bad reviews from Camp Paradise for harassing people around there, and harassing, ironically, not just Camp Paradise people, but any homeless people who happen to be around that place, because he couldn't get at Camp Paradise, he was harassing people on the edges of Camp Paradise. But the point is, Crone has not taken a stand in any definable, consistent way around these issues. I mean, one has the sense that he would like to, one has the sense that his heart, in some sense, is in the right place, but if an individual has the power and then chooses not to exercise it repeatedly, again and again, over the course of 2.5 years, and actually it's 2 years and a quarter, he's now been in office since November 1998, let's say for 26 months, then you have to hold him accountable for this, and also you have to abandon any illusions you may have about pretty words. There's a reason I call him Candygram Crone. I don't call him that because I've decided I'll just alienate everybody in the world and trash him to start with. No, I mean, I began with a lot of praise for Christopher Crone. After all, back in November of 1998, just after he was elected, he went to a rally at the town clock and stood with Steve Argue and Keith Sugar against police violence and the murder of innocent people, the Stolen Lives Project. And he talked about, he was there when we criticized the police department's lack of investigation, lack of independent investigation of the killing of Happy John Dine by Officer Connor Carey in 1997. That was the last killing until Quentin was killed this year by, oh gosh, a number of police officers. They riddled him full of bullets. Raymond Quinton was his name, and that was this last summer. Anyway, Crone was there, and then he stood up and he spoke on police issues. But really, that was about the last thing he did of any substance in any consistent public way. I mean, there were some sort of smaller moves around the issue of police reform. He tried to stop the shoulder tap law, and he had a sort of a one-man effort fighting that law, and I commended him for that. He spoke about it at city council, but he never kind of mobilized his troops. He never held public meetings and said, let's everybody get together and do something here, because he wanted to be a team player, I guess. You know, and maybe that's the undoing of these council members. They want to be team players. He didn't, in the last 2 years, get the police review board, although he could have through his representative, Sandy Brown, who began to do less and less and ended up missing more meetings than any other CPRB member in history. He could have gotten the CPRB to examine the budget of the police department, but year after year, he didn't do that either. You know? Then on the issue of the sleeping ban, well, the very first meeting that he went to that was about a substance, the December 1998 meeting, he went to a meeting before that, but that wasn't really a meeting of substance because he'd just been elected, but this was the last meeting before the winter, and people had to leave, and it was the council was going to be leaving for the winter, and they were going to be going on recess, and the pressure was high on the city council to do something about ending the sleeping ban or suspending it for the winter. We finally had the votes. Catherine Byers and then the three new council members, Crone, Fitzmaurice, and Sugar, were going to be the people who would change this anti-homeless law, who would start dealing with the shelter issues that kept 1,000 to 2,000 people outside in the winter that resulted in more than 41 deaths in the year 2000, the next year. And what he did was, he passed a resolution saying sleeping is a human right. He actually met with activists, including me and others, and tried to pound something out at the old Saturn Cafe. He supported Councilmember Sugar's resolution that the camping and sleeping bans be suspended over the winter, or at least the sleeping portions of the camping ban, unless there was a health and safety concern, that people not ticket. And he was voted down. But ever since then, there have been essentially no new initiatives by him, no attempts to continue to raise the issue. In fact, he's gotten worse. Though he did vote in May of 2000, along with Sugar and Byers and Fitzmaurice, for the first reading of a change in the law that would have allowed industrial zone sleeping, he voted again for that, and on the losing side in June, when it was brought up in a midnight meeting by Catherine Byers inappropriately, in my mind, in a violation of the Brown Act, because it wasn't adequately agendized, so the public didn't really know what was going on. He lost that vote, and yet, when he got two new people on the city council, like Riley and Porter, and possibly even Kennedy, though I don't think Premack would have joined in, all he needed was one of those votes, and Ed Porter had committed himself to ending the sleeping ban in solemn commitments to the Green Party before he got their endorsement. He refused to bring that issue up, either as a council member or as mayor, for 14 months, and he still isn't willing to bring it up because he doesn't want to, well, I don't know, squander his political capital. I'm not sure what his problem is. But it's okay for people to suffer. It's okay for this issue to remain a pariah issue. It's okay for the recommendations of his own Homeless Issues Task Force, and he's the one who created it. It was his idea back in 1999, and it was passed as a sort of a sop to people because Catherine Byers sold out the task force to examine the camping ordinance. She was the council member who was first going to help and then turned against the civil rights forces. And so Crone got this sop from her in the council that there would be this Homeless Issues Task Force. But because the Homeless Issues Task Force did not get into the family shelter, that's all apparently Byers wanted out of them was a family shelter, and they're getting their family shelter anyway. And why do they need a Homeless Issues Task Force to establish a little family shelter? Another one of those token projects that's going to be helpful for 40 or 50 people, but has nothing to do with the great majority of homeless people who are outside, the 1,000 to 2,000 people who need campgrounds, car parks, decriminalization of sleeping somewhere. I mean, it's pretty obvious. Crone has not just failed, he's got some fundamental failure of will here. And I guess the community has to bring this up, not really so much criticize him per se, but push the issue. You can leave the criticizing of Crone to me. I'd be happy to do the criticizing. I guess I do feel the criticizing has to continue. The criticizing, making these figures publicly embarrassed to be in public places, this is the way eventually you get a response. You make it hot for them. You can be nice for a while, but when you see that they just aren't listening, then you have to raise your voices until they have to listen. That's how it's been in civil rights struggles throughout history, and I think that's how it is here in Santa Cruz. And that's how it was, I think, with Camp Paradise. Camp Paradise just wanted to exist, and Fitzmaurice went down there and essentially, I guess, either with a wink and a nod or through inaction, had the police running down there, threatening people, ticketing them, taking them to court. And then Camp Paradise organized, went public, and said, this is wrong. We've cleaned up the area. We've essentially become much more drug-free, much more clean and sober. We serve as even an overflow area for people from the city's own interface satellite shelter program that can't get in because it's full. And all these were true statements that Fitzmaurice and Crone would not face. I haven't heard Christopher Crone stand up at City Council and say there is no shelter space for the overwhelming majority of people. Why hasn't he done that? All you fans of Christopher Crone out there, all you folks, Fred Geiger, who I repeatedly try to get on this show to call in, who won't do it, apparently. He's never at home. He doesn't want to be bothered with this stuff. He's got positive things to say about the City Council. I just want to say them publicly anymore. I don't know. I mean, I invite anyone who has got some positive things to say about Christopher Crone to call in and let me know. And the reason I do is because I have a meeting with him coming up this week. He's not meeting with me about the sleeping ban. He is meeting with me about the issue of public process and so-called decorum at City Council. And I'm going to be talking about this later in the show. It's a very important issue because it extends not just to homeless issues, but to all issues that the public wants to bring up before the Santa Cruz City Council, and how people are essentially muzzled, how they are sidelined, how council members can talk for hours and hours and hours, but the public gets 3 minutes, often cut to 2 minutes, occasionally cut to 1 minute. I've had my time cut to 30 seconds when I've had matters of substance to say that you have a right to say under the State Brown Act, the Public Meetings Act, the Open Meetings Act, that requires City Council to listen to people even if it doesn't want to, because it's not just the City Council that's listening, it's the community, and that's as important as the City Council. We're going to be talking about that. I'm going to be looking for input from you on the issues of what to discuss with Mayor Crone at that meeting. Who says I don't try to be reasonable? I'm not interested in spending a lot of time at City Council posturing in a bathrobe with a teddy bear. I don't particularly, it may look like I enjoy it, but I'll tell you, it's hot under those robes, and I look pretty dumb, and I get people coming up to me and saying, "You're just not going to get laid that way, buddy." I'll tell you, it's not the best costume, it's not the best outfit in the world. It is simply a satirical, theatrical approach that I think is a way of drawing some attention. But if there is a better way of doing it, and if the City Council members want to respond in a more reasonable fashion to your ordinary dialogue, your day-to-day, look, let's get together and reasonably discuss this thing, hey, that's great too. But unfortunately, that has not been what I've found in the past. That's just not what they do. They respond to public pressure and the potentialities for embarrassment. They don't respond to reasonable discussion in 9 out of 10 cases, unfortunately. And so anyway, I'll be asking you for your suggestions on that. I'll be telling you what I'm going to be, in, what's on my agenda and what I'd like to see discussed. And I'm hoping that you'll have some of your thoughts and we can pass these on to the mayor and see what he has to say about that. And I'll be giving you a report back on his thoughts and whether we're going to be getting any changes in the City Council decorum, which currently is very, very repressive. We've just come out of the Fitzmaurice regime. I called him Emperor Fitz or Fuhrer Fitzmaurice. It's a man who got elected as a Green Party member and, of course, has completely abandoned any kind of Green Party process. He's made extensive use of the police and threats and sort of the mismanners. Decorum is my middle name approach. He initiated a lawsuit against me and two other people for essentially lobbying at the City Council offices when he, again, like Crone, failed to put anything like the sleeping ban on the agenda and allowed homeless people just to rot outside all winter in the rain and cold and face criminal penalties for trying to shelter themselves under the sleeping and camping bans. And there's someone say, well, it wasn't him who did this, it was Anna Brooks, his secretary. She claimed that we were harassing her. Well, that was dismissed 6 months later, of course, after the entire impetus of the demonstration had been destroyed by Judge Stevens, but it was still dismissed. It was a bogus claim, and it was initiated by political figures, that is my belief, in the City Council offices. And Crone, unfortunately, is following that tradition of repression, and that, if he can change that, if we can start off in a different way, that it will hopefully be a positive thing. And at least, even if he chooses not to address issues, if he lets the public bring up the issues, if they get some time to do so, if there is a fair process, then at least we can say we're starting down the right road. And that's what I hope to be talking about with him. Phone number to call in here at Free Radio Santa Cruz is 427-3772. 427-3772. In case you're catching this by computer on the internet. It's www.microradio.net/frsc, in case you want to tune in. You're going out of town, you might want to catch us when you're, you know, when you're somewhere else, because we would really like to hear what's happening elsewhere in the world. The area code here is 831, in case you're dialing from out of the area, 831-427-3772.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Robert.
Hey.
Hey, does the ACLU ever do anything for the homelessness around here? And I'll take the answer off the phone, bro.
Okay.
Thank
sure.
you.
Of course, I haven't been to ACLU meetings recently. We brought the issue of the sleeping ban to the ACLU, and they've essentially buried it. They haven't been interested in the sleeping ban. Now, in other cities, they have. For example, when I was working in Southern California as a sort of an ombudsperson, legal worker for Santa Barbara Legal Defense Center back in 1992-93, ACLU was involved in a 5-cities, actually became a 7-cities lawsuit against sleeping and camping bans down south, but not the Santa Cruz ACLU. The Santa Cruz ACLU has generally kept a hands-off policy on homeless issues. Now, there have been a couple of minor exceptions. For example, in 1996, when then-Mayor Rotkin, ably supported by Councilmember Kennedy, was tearing down signs like they were going out of style in front of City Hall, the signs that we put up about ending the sleeping ban, when he tried to have an injunction leveled against the demonstration, and one that went on for 7.5 months, this demonstration outside City Hall, 24 hours a day, asking that the city, which had destroyed the Coral Street open-air shelter, the same people who had essentially caused the deaths of somewhere between 6 and 12 homeless people in the months that followed, according to activist Dan Hopkins, that Mayor Rotkin and the city council act to decriminalize sleeping somewhere. Somewhere. Just you have to sleep at night. It's just very simple. And Rotkin's response to all this was to go to court and try to get it illegal, make it illegal to protest at City Hall at night, and also during the day. He was able to get the judge to rule that if you fell asleep at any point at City Hall, if you fell asleep, it would be a misdemeanor punishable by up to 6 months in jail and $1,000 fine, be an act of contempt of court as well. He didn't get his nighttime injunction, but he got a partial injunction against the protest, which we still continued nonetheless. The ACLU in that case supported our right to have signs, but not to sleep. So, Bob Terran, Isabel Gilmore, thank you very much. There's some of the there's a lot of ACLU people who are sympathetic to ACLU on national issues, or even on, I would say, issues like this issue we had on the air here recently on Free Radio, talking about Amy and Cassandra, who put up a bed sheet on the Scotts Valley overpass right next to the flag and a sign that said, "I Love New York," saying at what cost, essentially presenting a negative view of the latest military adventurism in Afghanistan, the Bomb the Rubble campaign, and let's search every cave we can and get rid of all our civil rights while we're doing so, by Führer Bush. I haven't made myself clear about my opinions on that. I can go on. ACLU, I think, I'm not sure if it's taken a stance on that, but that's the kind of thing that they might get involved with, which is a very sort of content-neutral situation where an unpopular, or actually here, I think, relatively popular position, but unpopular with the government and some economic and political powers in the area, is challenging the some discriminatory behavior. I think this case is by Caltrans. The ACLU also supported, in 1994, protests against the sitting ban, which was a more direct ACLU involvement in homeless people's struggles. There was a law passed by Mayor Kennedy, now Councilmember Kennedy, and his gang on the city council, which made it illegal for people to sit down anywhere on the sidewalk. And it's now been, the court threw out that law, actually, after massive protest and ACLU assistance. And it's now illegal to sit 10 feet from a store and 50 feet from an ATM and 4 feet from a telephone booth or a drinking fountain. However, the ACLU would not support people like Linda Edwards, who was an activist, because she was associated with me. And I was involved in active organizing against the sitting ban and against the sleeping ban. And various people in the ACLU, like Margaret Marr, had personal issues with me, perhaps, or they didn't like the fact that I had demanded that their meetings be open some years before when they were doing organizing, and they'd wanted to hold kind of closed meetings, and I'd protested that publicly. So they wouldn't... There's been a rather bad track record of the ACLU locally, and that's a real pity. And I'm kind of... I'd like to see that change. I don't know who actually is heading the ACLU now, and if somebody out there wants to begin working on that issue and making contacts with the ACLU, Huff meets every Wednesday at 8:30 on Wednesday morning at the Baker Square Restaurant, which is the pie shop on Ocean Street right across from Beach City Gas. So you might want to come into that meeting with some thoughts at 8:30 in 3 days. Or you can call in to Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. And that's a 24-hour voicemail line. You won't get a real person, but you will get a real callback if you have some contact point. If you don't have a contact point, if you don't have a phone number, leave a place where you're likely to be if you want to be reached by phone. It's hard for homeless people, of course, they don't have phones. And if you want to get a phone and you're homeless, you should contact the Community Action Board. They have a phone voicemail service that it's not too difficult to get into. You can get a voicemail number if you're homeless, and that's one of the good projects of Community Action Board shelter project worker Paul Brindell, who has earned mixed reviews from me, but certainly good reviews for that particular project. Good work, Paul, on that one. You can give him a call at 457-1741. 457-1741 if you're looking for a voicemail. And if you forget that number, it's under the Community Action Board in the phone book. That's a Community Action Board. You won't be able to catch them today, although I think there may be a voicemail there, so you could leave them a message. But on Monday, you'll be able to do that. You have to run around to the Homeless Services Center, I think, fill out papers, go back. But you will eventually, my understanding is correct, get a voicemail. And that can be really key, and I encourage people to do that, so you can have people where, you know, if you're trying to get work, you can get work, you can have a number you can be called back on, although it is really clearly a homeless kind of number, and that may prejudice a number of job providers or people who are seeking job, people doing jobs, so that is a problem with that. That kind of is my number on the ACLU, also studded with all kinds of other information and possible irrelevancies, but yeah, the ACLU hasn't been too active here. In fact, it has been hostile to, at least to me personally, and to people who are doing strong protests, partially because I think ACLU members have a sort of relatively close relationships with city council members, and they have this sort of belief that if they're nice enough to this latest incoming siren song voices, they'll get some response. And unfortunately, that has not been the case. So it doesn't mean the ACLU couldn't change. It doesn't mean the people in the ACLU couldn't demand that there be action. The Green Party, for example, has changed somewhat, although it's still, it has this process whereby Fitzmaurice can veto proposals that come in. At least he did at the last meeting when I proposed that there be a resolution asking for support for a tent city over the winter, because obviously city council wasn't going to do anything about the homeless crisis, and it was vetoed by Fitzmaurice, by a guy who I dismiss as a crony of his, but you know, I'm sure he has his own views too, Jeffrey Smedberg, and there was another person who vetoed it. I wasn't actually at the meeting. I was there initially to present it, but sitting through 2 hours of a meeting to be allowed 30 seconds, or actually 3 minutes at the end of the meeting, you're probably going to get vetoed, is my idea of a good time or a sensible use of time, so I don't always do that. But I did present it to the Green Party, suggesting it, that this is something they needed to do. And in fact, in the last 4 months, they have passed some good resolutions, supporting Camp Paradise, supporting ending the sleeping ban. The Green Party platform asks all sleeping bans be ended. And in November, they actually passed one of my resolutions, which was that the Green Party members ask publicly and privately to city to office holders endorsed by the Green Party that they follow the Green Party platform, particularly given the shelter crisis. and that was passed. So I don't know that any Green Party members have done that, but the resolution was passed, and I think a letter was written to Fitzmaurice, but I don't know if it's ever been delivered. That's another interesting question. They get lost in these process catacombs, which to me indicates that at some level, and I got to say this, they don't give a shit. I mean, I know a lot of people do feel they give a shit, that they're putting in a lot of energy helping Camp Paradise, for example, and I commend them on this. But in turn, but they are, you know, they believe that being directly confrontational with politicians in power who have a little green label on them is just not the way to go. And so Ed Porter, who's not a Green Party person, but who's Green Party endorsed, and Tim Fitzmaurice, who is a Green Party person, and as I said, he ran the last Green Party assembly meeting, and he vetoed my resolution. You don't want to cross him. No. You don't want to, you know, you got to be, let's all be friendly and clap each other on the back and peace and love and that sort of thing. Well, everybody goes to hell outside. And that may sound a little cynical and maybe an oversimplification of what happens, but you got to look at the Green Party's behavior for the last 2 years on issues around the homeless. And it's been pretty bad until the last 6 months. And now it's been sort of mixed. And there are a lot of Green Party people, a number of strong Green Party people, who looked at Camp Paradise and said, whatever its warts, whatever its faults, the Camp Paradise is, on the whole, a very good thing, and it's strange that the city council is not acknowledging this, and in fact is moving to try to crush it, because that's really what the city council is doing. They didn't have an evacuation plan for Camp Paradise, even though they said they were going to. These vouchers that they found for motels are fine in a certain sense, but in another sense, they're discriminatory because other homeless people don't get these Camp Paradise-type vouchers. So it creates these divisions and hostility. What Camp Paradise really needs is a place to set up a campground, and there needs to be a program for showing other campers how to do that too, so they can become useful to, you know, for environmental concerns. So they can start, in essence, paying their own way, if that's the big, right-wing cry of the moment. Let's everybody pay their own way. In fact, it's much cheaper to have low-income campgrounds, to have people running around trying to hide out and dumping their trash and debris, you know, wherever they can, and essentially disrespecting the law because the law disrespects them. To me, it's been pretty obvious. And in honor of Pat Kittle, I'll throw in another statement that everybody who's out there camping should try to camp in a clean and reasonable fashion. Pack your trash, camp lightly on the land, and you don't have to kiss the city council members' feet every time you see them, either. By the way, that's from me. It's been suggested that while the city council is acting badly by making it criminal for people to survive, that the people who are surviving are acting badly by doing it in a messy way. I don't see these things as equivalent, but I acknowledge the point that people should, you know, respect the environment and people should try to camp lightly. And I'm just suggesting that if you're doing so in a survival fashion, it's different than if you're doing so as a upper-middle-class environmentalist on a weekly walk through the area. It's a little different, and I think that there have to be, to some extent, different standards, but I think it's important for people to respect the environment. I think it's important for all of us to make that possible by not pulling out porta-potties like the city council is doing. There were 5 of them put in. 2 of them have been torn out without public hearings. None of them have been put into industrial zones, as was mandated by Crone's council back in 1999, and that's going to be something else that I'll be bringing up with Christopher at this meeting, although, again, the meeting is not really about issues around the sleeping ban. It's about how the process at city council can be a more open one. Anyway, I would go on forever if I could. Let's see if we can take a breather here. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. And the call-in number, in case you've forgotten or haven't heard it yet, is 427-3772, 427-3772, area code 831 if you're out of the area, 831-427-3772, and the lines are open. We just want to let you know that we have a special guest who will be calling in at 1230, Wiley Drake of Buena Park, California. More about him in a moment.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Oh, I'll be looking forward to hearing from Wiley Drake.
Sounds like
an interesting
Becky.
Person. Yes, this is Becky Johnson calling in, and I wanted to respond to a letter or an article in Sentinel in today's paper by Sentinel staff writer Dan White, called Homeless Camp Became a Divisive Community Issue.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I guess it's sort of their yearly wrap-up of the Camp Paradise situation.
Maybe you should read the article first, because I haven't read it, and I don't know if other people have access to this $1.50 Sunday Sentinel, you know.
Oh, that is. I cheaped out and got it online myself for nothing.
Is it worth reading aloud?
Well, it might relieve your listeners from hearing your voice going
on. That's for sure. Why don't you go ahead?
So I suppose that's a possibility. Okay. Sick of its reputation as a bar brawler, ex-con Larry Templeton fled the Midwest in 1984. 17 years later, this dead ringer for Buffalo Bill is notorious again, this time as the founder of the only area homeless camp brazen enough to have bylaws, a lawyer, an environmental consultant, and a name, Camp Paradise. Little errors there, but we'll skip them for the moment. Templeton's group stayed on the San Lorenzo River levee near the Highway 1 overpass. The camp grew to 60 residents, dwindled to 30, then got washed away in winter rains, forcing city staff and ex-campers to clean up the mess. But the camp's impact has outlasted its life, making Templeton the Sentinel's choice for Santa Cruz Newsmaker of the Year 2001. Residents still debate whether Templeton's creation was eco-friendly or a group seeking special treatment and free land. Whether they admire him or consider him a huckster, local residents would have to admit Templeton turned his camp into an arguing point about homelessness. Since becoming an activist in Santa Cruz, quote, I learned I didn't have to use physical force to get what I want, he said last week. I learned I could talk to people. By courting media and selling an eco-friendly image, he focused attention on homelessness, dominated city council business, and got a coalition of Quakers and activists on his side. Ken Cole, director of the Homeless Services Center in Santa Cruz, does not think camps can ever be a solution for homelessness, but admires Templeton. What stands out for me is the yeoman's work he did in holding the camp together, Cole said. He's got a gift of the gab. I think he's a natural-born salesman. Overall, I think the image he created for the camp was positive and helpful to the cause of trying to get the public to deal with homelessness. Templeton worked crowds, passing out cookies to a city council audience, telling council members, I love you, when things went smoothly, and asking, why do you hate us, when things got rocky. He hired a lawyer to fight the tickets 10 campers got for public squatting. Some believe the image he promoted of campers picking up tons of trash along the levee. Others complained about junk and public urination near the camp. An assistant district attorney visited the site in November and said campers were using holes under the trees as latrines. But the critics must give the place points for originality. In most homeless camps, residents flee at the first sign of police. Camp Paradise was almost comically out in the open. Its ex-attic tenants gave public tours. When they're hiding, they must be doing something wrong, said Templeton, talking about hidden camps. I don't want to hide anymore. When Templeton first arrived in Santa Cruz, he smoked cocaine at what was known as Heroin Alley along the river. About a year ago, he got sober. He kicked out addicts, Templeton said. Most campers identified themselves as recovering alcoholics or ex-addicts. Many live on disability checks, but others hold jobs. Templeton, an ex-construction worker who gets about $680 a month in Social Security payments, is still looking for a new spot for the group, now holed up at New Brighton State Beach. He said it's unfair to ask them to move to a cheaper locale. I'd still be homeless in Modesto or Fresno, he said. Another point of contention. Camp Paradise's remaining 20 ex-campers refused to move into the 100-person capacity emergency shelter at the National Guard Armory, which is a little more than half full now and costs the city more than $50,000 a year in rent. The city paid $4,400 to shelter the campers in a motel for 2 weeks. Activist Paul Lee also helped with the bill. But Templeton said ex-campers might backslide or be provoked into fights if they go to the armory. Templeton said the campers are merely getting their due. Hey, they gave us a motel and we appreciated it, he said. We felt someone noticed all the garbage we picked up. It makes us want to continue to bust our butts because one day it will work out for us.
And that was Dan White, Sentinel article in today's paper, huh?
That's correct. I have a couple corrections. First off, there were 33 tickets issued, and they were issued for setting up a campsite.
Not for squatting.
Not 10 tickets for squatting. And I think squatting is a rather derogatory term to use.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, the $50,000 the city pays for the armory shelter is offset by the state, subsidizing 100 days at $350 per night. The church program, which houses 58 in winter, likewise receives federal and state funds as well as private donations. And the third point I wanted to make is there's no doubt about the amount of trash picked up by campers at Camp Paradise. City Public Works Department kept records of trash removed, but they have not publicized these numbers yet. The campers estimate 24 tons was removed from the Camp Paradise site.
Mm-hmm.
And that's your Sentinel for you.
Well, I could play devil's advocate and ask you a few hard questions if you want to stand in for Larry Templeton, or I could call him up and hassle him.
Oh, well, I could give it a shot.
Hmm. Well, the concern I voiced was that Camp Paradise is getting the special treatment from the city, these motel vouchers, the essentially, to some extent, hands-off policy after the August 3rd ticketing, although there was continued harassment from Officer Seeley. While other people in other camps elsewhere who not as well organized, not as well publicized, not as well supported, are getting harassed big time.
Okay, can I respond to that?
Sure.
Those vouchers for the motel rooms were actually offered before the camp got flooded out. And then when the camp got flooded out, the city was somewhat embarrassed in having to put up the money that they had previously offered for those motel vouchers.
Right, I know that they offered it on the proviso that the camp sort of dry up and blow away, or in this case, I guess, wet down and float away. The idea was, you know, here's your hush money, get out of town kind
mm-hmm.
of thing, was the way, I guess, it was originally presented before the washout.
And I don't think the campers were too interested in the vouchers before they got washed out either, because while staying in a motel is certainly worthy housing for a night, it's so short term, and when the voucher runs out, the person is pretty much back where they started, having no place to stay at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, the concerns that homeless people have brought to me around Camp Paradise have been issues like the concern that Larry Templeton exercises a very kind of authoritarian control over the camp, and that, indeed, one can hear exclamation threats and violence, not actual violence, although that's been suggested, too, at different times, that there's a sort of cult personality going on there. That's another exchange that's come to me from different homeless people. Now, I'm not saying that these are necessarily true criticisms, but what would be your response to that?
I think there is an element of that, and that troubles me.
But it doesn't trouble you enough to stop defending Camp Paradise.
Well, I mean, the concept of Camp Paradise and the individual campers in Camp Paradise deserve to be defended.
Mm-hmm.
They've done a very good job of being ecologically friendly, of investigating every possible legal alternative, and they've been frustrated at every step of the way by the city.
Mm-hmm.
However, the community has turned out, and the city council is afraid of the adverse publicity that would come from really clamping down on Camp Paradise.
Well, I heard today from an informed source that the assistant city manager was approached by this person who's been active as a sort of a social service provider activist kind of person who asked him, you know, what was going on with this missing report that, because October 23rd, City Council told this, the city manager's office to get a report together, not just on an evacuation plan, but on alternate sites for Camp Paradise, possibly in the city parks. And this was supposed to come back and didn't come back, and still hasn't come back to City Council, though I guess Crone says it should be back in early January. And what the city manager said, according to this source, was that, you know, they're looking around, but the parks employees are up in arms. They don't want those dirty homeless people, you know, they have to, working with them, and they also are concerned about, they can't find, you know, shelter spaces like warehouses where the neighbors don't object. And then reportedly Martine said, why don't these people just sort of do a lower profile? Wouldn't that be a better thing? And what this activist told Martine was that the same suggestion was given to homeless people 15 or 20 years ago around the issue of voting. It was then illegal to register to vote, let's say, at a grate or in a field or at some address where you, you know, couldn't be contacted as having a regular residence. And the county council, according to this activist, as she told, or he told, actually, the and later was people in Santa Barbara had to block the freeway to get the vote federally. Homeless people, they blocked 101 in 1995, and then they got the vote 1985. And in Santa Cruz, there was a lawsuit, which was connected with the progressives here in the 80s, that had nothing to do with the homeless, but had to do with university students, that finally gave them the vote where they happen to be, and they don't have to, you know, claim they're at an address where they're couch surfing when they're really not going to be there for, you know, more than a few nights. And the point, I guess, is that Camp Paradise, you know, that what you recommend to people, you know, this lay low profile approach, that's what's really being imposed on the entire homeless community. And that's the second criticism of Camp Paradise, is that why aren't Camp Paradise people standing up for the camping and sleeping ban victimized greater homeless community? I mean, instead they seem to be engaging in accommodations to make a sort of a special deal with themselves. This, by the way, doesn't represent my position. These are criticisms from people in the homeless community. What would you say to that?
Well, I think that there is an element of Camp Paradise looking out for their own interests first. However, the court case that went forward where the Camp Paradise defendants used the necessity defense, that could have far-reaching effects for all homeless people, especially now that the appeal has been filed, and that really sprang from Camp Paradise and its supporters. Also, just the concept of an ecologically earth-friendly camp has been copied by other homeless camps, where they too have seen the benefit of establishing a positive image to the community and publicizing that, and I think we might see more of that with Camp Paradise having set a model for that.
Another thing missing from Dan White's article, I note, is that there's not a word about Dignity Village, Tent City 3, or Camp Goodwill, which are homeless encampments in Portland, Oregon, Seattle, Washington, and Toronto, Canada, which have been running for over a year, and actually they're running illegally, and they move from place to place, and some of them get funding from, ironically, from the city that they're in, even though they're illegal, not just private people, but city agencies. And you get no inkling that this is something that, in fact, is really a housing alternative. That is to say that you have it's not just a situation of here's this clever con man from the Midwest who comes out and, you know, gathers a bunch of people around him and demands shelter. Rather, it is a bunch of people who need some legal place to be faced with a situation.
I think it's kind of a little bit sour grapes on the part of Ken Cole that Camp Paradise actually was able to provide more and better housing throughout the summer months for homeless people than his entire homeless services center program. The ISSP sheltered fewer people. Was not a 24-hour shelter, and it cost a lot of money. And the Camp Paradise people sheltered a lot of people and didn't cost the city a dime. And so Ken Cole may not be the best person to be extolling the virtues of Camp Paradise, because it does put his own programs in a bad light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and his programs are coming from a lot of criticism from Larry Templeton and others in terms of the not just their inaccessibility, but the fact that there's a lot of drug use going on there. And I don't know if there is or not. That's the claim again.
Certainly are people who are active drug and alcohol users who use the program, and that's been a chief concern of the Camp Paradise people, who are a clean and sober community and struggle every day with that. It's just a fundamental rule for a person who's trying to kick drugs or alcohol to just get out of the scene. Don't be around people who are using drugs and alcohol, because it's so easy to slide back into that scene. And that's been a chief objection for people who probably could use the Armory, in the sense that they have photo ID and haven't been excluded for some other reason.
Well, there also the problem of working late at night and so forth. I guess you can try to get in a church group if you're working late at night, if you're working during the day and you can't get back there before 3:30 or 4 when the Armory line begins. We've been talking with Becky Johnson, who's an activist with HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and I guess you were giving us the skibby on this Dan White overview of Camp Paradise, and was Larry Templeton the man of the year? Is that the deal?
Well, I'm not sure about that.
I wanted to be man of the year. What's going on here, man?
I think they had that surfer, Jay Moriarty, who actually came in as the man of the year.
Surfers come first, that's true.
Which, I don't know.
Hmm. Well, thank you for the update. Anything you want to add?
Let's see. We're having a HUF meeting Wednesday, 8:30 at Baker Square. So if anybody's interested in working on some of these issues, we welcome people to come down, join us. And if you're homeless, HUF will spring for a cup of coffee for you.
Wow. You have a show also yourself, Becky, Club Cruise, coming up this week, don't you? At 7 o'clock on Channel 27 on the community TV station.
7 p.m., Channel 27, and we have kind of a long-awaited show about the critical mass bikers who were, they had kind of a problem with the Santa Cruz Police Department just a few days after September 11th when they had their first critical mass bike rally, and a lot of people had some anti-war slogans as well that they were displaying. And so we have that, and the show was somewhat taped a couple months ago, but my co-producer, Nick Whitehead, was able to secure an interview with Lieutenant Larson of the Santa Cruz Police Department, and so there'll be, I believe, a four-minute interview with Lieutenant Larson as well.
Hmm. Well, have you got any update on what's happened to those folks? I know critical mass people did speak on the air here about how they were abused by police, dragged across the streets, essentially stopped from a critical mass bicycle ride because they had signs against the war, and then just sort of harassed along the route until that happened as well. And now they were taken to court for some of their so-called violations. You know what went on there?
I don't know the outcome of those court cases. I do know that some of the bikers have filed complaints with the Citizens Police Review Board. So those should be coming up on an upcoming docket.
Oh, dear. Okay, well, thank you very much for that update. And again, folks can tune in at 7 o'clock on Channel 27 if you have cable TV Tuesdays and Thursdays for Club
Cruise. Yes, rebroadcast on Thursdays also at 7 in direct opposition to your show, Robert.
Indeed. Well, you can tune back and forth. Thank you for calling in.
Set your VCR.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
And in case I sound a little more tired than usual, it's because I am fighting the flu. So you can send all your flu remedies to Uncle Robert here at Free Radio. This is Free Radio, 96.3 FM. It's the 2.5-hour edition of Bathrop's Piers Broadsides. We don't get as much time as some Free Radio broadcasters, but we get more than others. So I guess we shouldn't be complaining a lot. You can call in at 427-3772 if you want to join the show. The lines are open. As I said, in half an hour, we're going to have Wiley Drake, a conservative Republican Baptist preacher from Southern California, of all things, calling in to report on what's happening down at Buena Park. And I'm actually going to be reading a bit from some stories from Buena Park, some of them some months old, about his defense of homeless people. He's the fellow who put people up in his church, was essentially dragged into court for it on 5 misdemeanors, and was found guilty, but then was told that he was assigned many hours of community service, but told he'd already done the community service by putting the people up in his church. And he then continued to ignore the city's anti-homeless restrictions and continued to put people up in his church. And though he may be medieval in his views on gay people in Disneyland, he's organized a boycott against Disneyland for their violation of family values as he sees them. He is, in fact, way ahead of the curve on the issue of homeless civil rights and, helping homeless families with his own church and with his own time and with his own resources and with his own liberty, risking his own liberty. So we're going to be talking with him, assuming he calls in at 12:30 here on Free Radio. Now, December 21st was an interesting day. It was a day when I actually went out there to the Homeless Services Center and interviewed homeless people on, actually had them fill out questionnaires. We have a questionnaire called What's Happening Outside, Huff does, and we're trying to find out what's happening outside. Are people getting beaten up? Are they having a better time than they were? Are having trouble getting into social services? Are they having trouble finding a legal place to sleep at night? Yes, of course they are. There aren't such places for 90% of the people in the for 90% of the people 75% of the time. In the winter, there's space for about 15% of the homeless population if it tries to get in. That's in the armory and the church programs. Anyway, I went to the Homeless Services Center, but also on the 21st, not only did we get these questionnaires dealt with and answered, and we're going to be having the results tabulated at some point in the future, there was also a service for the dead, the number of homeless people who died in the year 2001, and I recorded much of that service, and I'm going to play that recording now. It's a couple days late, or a couple shows late, and I apologize for that, but hopefully for those of you who weren't able to make it to this ceremony and who want to hear what went down, this is what happened.
December 21st, 2001, Homeless Services Center. The Homeless Memorial is coming up here on the day after the Salt Works.
All right, now we're talking to...
My name's Al.
Hey, Al, so you're concerned about public restroom situation.
Public restrooms, there's no public restrooms. I went down to Borders. They said, no, we closed our bathrooms too. Starbucks closed theirs. Roasting Company's been closed for 5 years. Now the public restrooms down around the corner from Borders are closed. There's no public restrooms anywhere in Santa Cruz. You have to piss on the side. So the officer chased me down. I said, I'm pissing down the alley. He followed me down, but I pissed in time. And he says, where did you take a piss at? I said, I'm not telling you. I just took my leak. I'm relieved.
And you're relieved, too. Get the hell out of here, right?
Yeah. But anyway, go down there, find out, and I'm going to let you know. You won't get no bathrooms. They locked them all up. We don't have no public restrooms down in Santa Cruz at all right now.
Now, when did this happen? When was this incident with the police?
About a week ago. And I told the officer, I said, how come the public restrooms are up? We don't have them because we don't have the facility, the repair for what the damages are. And I go, well, I'm a customer. I have my credit card, my Visa. I pay taxes. How come there's no public restroom? I'm going down to some alleyway. If you do, sir, I'll give you a $200 fine. I jogged. He jogged behind me. I raced him around in logos, and there was something in the corner, but I pissed in there. And he asked me where I took a piss at, and I just said, I just took a leak. He looked for it. He couldn't find it. And I said, I'm on my way. I'm relieved.
Get yourself a piss detector if you want to find where I did my piss.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm just letting you know there's no public restrooms in Santa Cruz at all, downtown Santa Cruz at all, for any of the public people who are handicapped or anything like that. They'll just reject you.
Did the officer or anybody else try to refer you? Because there were
a few outhouses, but they haven't been cleaned, and they're pretty dirty and broken, and they... I just don't understand why Santa Cruz County has outhouses. That's embarrassing.
Well, they don't want to spend money on you homeless types, you know.
We're not dealing with the homeless people. They're rejecting regular people.
Hey, regular people, if they pay enough money, can go buy a cup of coffee at
a restaurant and go use their bathroom.
In a way, they can, but they close up their bathrooms, too.
Hey, thank you, Al. John Hamilton, you have a no-war button. How are you doing? Are you homeless these days?
Or no, I'm not.
So are you, what brings you to this the Homeless Services Center? Are you just leeching off the poor? What's going on?
The people I work with over here told me about it, and I know a couple of the people that died.
I see. You work. Which people did you work with?
I'm working with the Homeless Help Project.
I got you.
Yeah, I'm doing landscaping. Yes. Right next door.
And it looks like we got social service providers. There's Eric Seeley, Paul Brindell. Looks like Ken Cole, head of the Homeless Service Center. Larry Templeton, schmoozing with the group.
Right here.
And there's Brian D. Kepke, long-term homeless activist and sometime worker for the Karen Gillette Free Meal.
I know. So where's the breakfast?
The breakfast came and went. We were earlier serving coffee. We have also, of course, a number of people I don't...
I want some stale donuts.
Stale donuts are available.
Okay, donuts.
Here comes Chris Fredrickson, who's working kind of a legal support person for Camp Paradise.
Right, so did you know that they got the house next door?
Huh?
Did you know that they got the house next door?
I do. That I was actually just there this morning.
Right? Oh, okay, right.
And we're having a meeting of homeless heads, so to speak, at Wednesday at 6 at the Santa Cruz Service Corps. If... Steve, the UCSC Huffman.
I would love to make that meeting, but I work Wednesday nights.
I see. Well, we'll find some other way to get you involved. Hey, Paul, what's the deal this year for homeless people in the death situation?
More blankets.
More blankets would be good.
Right. More blankets and rain gear is always good.
Right. I know the armory. I was told that they were actually they had 70 blankets and they were getting more people kind of that, and only one blanket per person. It was about a week or two ago.
Yeah, I think they could use more blankets. And so when people call us, we say, how about blankets to the armory? Yeah, definitely a good thing.
So what are your informal estimates of the number of dead this year?
Well, we have them, so you can have the paper. I'll be glad to give you the data. The big question is why are there fewer? And we don't really know the reason. The only thing that I can see on there is there seems to be a few less ODs.
41 dead last year in the county. How many this year?
I think it's 26, but you should let me give you the data and how we split it out. I have a copy back at the office.
Okay. This is Steve Weiss. Steve, this is Paul Andrew. Steve is with Huff UCSC, a homeless rights group. Paul is with the Homeless Health Project, Homeless Persons Health Project.
Yeah. So we can't make, you know, it's not like real data, scientifics, or to draw conclusions, you know, like people could say, hey, there's more shelter beds, or there's more this or more that. That's why there's less deaths. That really, those kind of...
Right. You just have to have rough estimates and
way
thoughts.
Right, yeah. And so let me get that for you. You should have it. And then you want last year so you can compare?
Sure. And in fact, as many years as you got. You
that's know. All we have. See,
right.
That's another reason why you can't draw conclusions on the data.
Well, we'll just have to do what we can.
That's right.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here.
All right. Ken Cole is speaking.
A little easier to be heard. I want to welcome everybody here to the second time that we've had a reading of the names memorial here at the Homeless Community Resource Center in this format. I know that there's probably been ceremonies like this for many years in Santa Cruz, but we're trying to kind of formalize how we gather the names of homeless people who were homeless at the time of their death in the past year and have a chance to read the names and share some things about their lives as the year comes to a close. I had no expectation that I'd be shielding my eyes from the sun, but I want to welcome the sun this morning as a symbol of light and hope. And we had actually thought we might have to have this event inside because of the rain, but we're very happy to be outside this morning because we think this is most appropriately done outside, because that's fundamentally one of the symbols of the realities of homelessness. What I like to do at the beginning of something like this is quickly describe what we're going to do so you understand just the structure of it. And it's very simple. We will have a couple of readings. Actually, we're going to invite a couple people to speak. One will be Paul Brindell from the Community Action Board, who's going to share a few thoughts with us. And then Mama Joy McCorkle, who many of you know from the homeless community, has some poetry that she's going to read. So there'll be that sort of as an opening. Then we're going to invite up a couple of people to actually read the names. And this year we have 26... Actually, we have 26 names to read from the formal list. And then there's been three additions that have come up as well. And I won't go into all the details of how that's done, but we're going to be reading 29 names at this point. We'll read the names at the end. The name will be read, and the age of the person will be stated. And then we have a chime. We're going to ring a chime with each name. I think after we read the names, we'll have probably a moment of silence, which is hard to have. I mean, it's an interesting moment here, in, as you can hear the sirens going by and the planes going overhead. But we'll have a moment of silence, and then we'll open things up if people have other contributions. And one of the contributions we have that we'll probably do first is Sherry Connable, who's a longtime advocate here in Santa Cruz for the homeless, has a little ceremony around sort of a wishing ceremony. And I just want to say at the top that this kind of event is twofold. One is, and most important, is that we recognize the humanity that we've lost, the people, the friends, some known, some completely unknown, that we've lost. So the true memorial aspect of reading the name and recognizing that loss. But part of recognizing that loss is to try to get some sense of closure so that it's not lingering. And then the second part of an event like this is to commit ourselves, or in some cases recommit ourselves, to the task of ending homelessness. Having this not be necessary at some point in the future. And we all know that that's a very, very big task in front of us as a society. I just want to say that we'll have a chance after the reading of the names again for people to contribute. So let me start us off, first of all, by inviting Paul Brindell up. I know Paul's close by.
Thanks, Ken. For a couple of days, I tried to write something. I went through my book of benedictions and all of my interfaith seminary work. I looked through the Quran and the Old Testament and the New Testament and quotations from Mark Twain and Thomas Mann, poetry, and there was nothing that I could pull out that would pull it all together in one slick quotation. So I spent some time looking at the people themselves. And at that time it was 26, now it's 29. Brothers and sisters and sons and daughters and children who we are here today to honor in passing. And I thought that it didn't feel right for me to make a political speech today. It felt, for me, better to come out of my interfaith tradition and to acknowledge all of the belief systems that are here today. And they aren't just a handful. We all bring from our own traditions our relationship to the infinite, to the glorious infinite. And I'm not going to pretend to understand what that is, because in my tradition it demeans it to even try and name it. But the great unnameable surrounds us today and is with us today and is with the 29. and we will mourn them, and their struggle, and their sadness, and their pain, which is over. Their suffering is done. And each of you knows in your own heart, where is questioning and attempting to answer the question of, well, where are they? Are they in peace? Are they happy? Are they in a better place? Each of us does that in our own way. For me, they live at least, and I can't say that it's less, at least in our hearts for as long as we remember them. And possibly in the heart of the infinite gloriousness that we all want to be there. And some of us know is probably there. And so we commend their souls and spirits to our memory and to the infinite.
Thank you, Paul. Now I'd like to ask Mama Joy to join us and read some poetry.
This is called Survivors. On the 21st of December, we are gathered here to see our friends who come to honor our comrades who've ceased to be. Some were friends, some were lovers, others pals, others foes. But each fought a battle with their habits, reign, and woes. We are all survivors, all from different wars. Each of us have won, but each with different scores. No longer will they hover out of the winter rain. No longer will they suffer from pain or disdain. For now they are peaceful, sheltered and well fed. It is only in our loss that we miss our sleeping dead. The next one I'm going to read, I haven't regretted many things I've done in my life. I've done a whole lot. But this was something I didn't do that I do regret. And it's written for Damien Carter, who they called Redbone. And it's called Act While You Can. Write Red, she said, he's got a great mind. He's one of those children who's a great find. Write Red, another told me, we can't lose such a high IQ. He's young, he's smart, he's strong. Please catch him before he goes wrong. Released from county jail, Red saw his future lost. Only heroin theft in prison could be the final cost. So before the age of 20, to avoid the addiction, pain, and strife, sadly and quietly, Red took his own life. And the last one I'm going to read is for Steve, who had the big yellow camper full of dogs that had one leg. It's called Black Sheep. Once they find their real names, the calls to relatives are made. But oftentimes informed, they don't care where we're laid. They don't want our animals, possessions, or truck. The city with all our remains are stuck. All black sheep of the family, they seemed relieved, were finally gone. No more calls from detox jails or pens. It seems our only family are other homeless friends. It is the dirty, shaggy homeless people who remember us with love. Hopefully our true worth will be judged from above. Like the tombstones of the gold rush, our epitaphs seem to say, arrived from Nevada, died unnamed the next day. Thank you very much.
And that was Mama Joy at the Homeless Services Center Memorial on December 21st. The memorial continues.
Thanks to Joy McCorkle for those poems. I want to recognize that there are many people here from the community in different ways. I mean, there are people here from the homeless community. There are people from the services that support and try to assist people. There's people just who read about it in the paper this morning and decided to were moved enough to come by. And I just want to really recognize all of you today for caring enough to be here, because we are talking about deaths that are very, very lonely deaths, and that's a part of the tragedy. I want to invite our mayor, Christopher Crone, to join me up here and welcome him. And I want to recognize that this is not a political event, and our mayor is not here for political reasons. And in fact, if he was worried about the political future, he probably wouldn't be here. So we know it's not a political thing for Chris to be here. He has a lot of concern for the people of the city, and he's brought a proclamation that he'd like to share with us.
Mayor Crone was there, of course, for political purposes, and he stayed anywhere between 5 and 15 minutes compared to the amount of time even that Mayor Fitzmaurice stayed last year, which was at least an hour. I don't think there was any other purpose than being there politically. Mayors are expected to show up at these ceremonies, so Homeless Services Center Director Ken Cole and I disagree on that particular issue.
Thank you all for being here, and as Ken just said, it's not a political event, and I know this is a day that's being honored across America, too, as far as recognizing the folks who have died and who have died alone, and I hope gatherings like this show that they're not alone, and that we need to put our arms out to those in need and those who without home. And, you know, this is a wonderful country, and it's blessed in so many ways, and so many, you know, you drive across America and you see how rich we are. And when you look at those that are most vulnerable, you quickly realize that we can do better. We can do better as a country, as a state, and as a community. And I'm reading this in solidarity with those other gatherings around the country today. Whereas adequate housing is essential for healthy families and communities, and whereas the combination of soaring housing costs and a shortage of both rental and single-family housing stock has led to housing becoming increasingly inaccessible to a number of Santa Cruz residents, many of whom are working full-time. Whereas untold numbers of homeless families are living with relatives or friends, and whereas each year too many people die alone. Whereas from December 21st, 2000 through December 20th, 2001, there were 26 deaths among homeless people in Santa Cruz County alone. Now we hear 29 today. Whereas December 21st, 2001 marks the 11th annual National Homeless Memorial Day, which brings attention to the tragedy of homelessness and remembers our homeless friends who have paid the ultimate price for our nation's failure to address this issue. Now therefore I, Christopher Crone, Mayor of the City of Santa Cruz, do hereby proclaim December 21st, 2001 as Homeless Memorial Day in the City of Santa Cruz, and urge all citizens to learn more about the housing crisis facing our state and to contribute in whatever ways they can to care and shelter of the homeless in our midst. Thank you.
Note what Mayor Crone did not do. He did not declare a housing emergency, which would have allowed him to take action to designate certain areas as shelters and to essentially override certain local ordinances, something that we've been trying to get done for years. He did not act to open up any additional shelter. He did not act to decriminalize anybody that night who was sleeping. He simply declared it was National Homeless Day.
I can't hear the wishing well here, so Sherry, if you could hold that for me. Thanks. So again, thank you for your patience, and I know it's a little hard to hear in the back, but it's a small price to pay. So I want to get us to the point now of actually reading the names and ask that Matt Nathanson, who's a public health nurse and someone who's been very involved in the collecting of the names, come forward, and also Linda Bradley, our program manager here at the Homeless Community Resource Center, and we'll all gather in again and listen to the names and the ages.
Carol Cranston, age 46. William Hall, 62. Danny Thatcher, 38. Curtis Parker, age 40. Richard LaBella, 54 years old. Robert Cox, 61. Errol Turner, 47. Armando Sanchez Rivas, 53. Kathleen Chandler, 32. Manuel Mays, 46. Sherry Whitaker James, 52. Larry Hart, 49. Greg Piasecki, 48. Steve Lyons, 50. Ronald Shin, 52.
Eduardo Urbina, 29. Michael Huff, 42. Patricia Doring, 53. Anil Singh, 47. Scott Stevenson, 38. Bridget Wilson, 54. Daniel Bean, 54. William Haynes, 54. James Dildine, 58. Juanita Caronco, 36. Lila Peterson, 86. Leon Rush, Sr., 57. Leon Rush, Jr., 39. Charles Terry, 84.
Reflect in a moment of silence. But I know it might have been hard to hear the names, and if you have a desire to see the list, we can share the actual list after the ceremony here today. Moving on a little bit to the future and to further closure, I want to invite Sherry Connable now to kind of lead us through a ceremony.
And Sherry then presented a bowl of water with a bouquet of flowers, inviting people to remember a dead person, a deceased person, a past person, by putting a flower in the water and saying something. And a number of people did this. Most of what they had to say is not really audible. It would have been intrusive to go up to them and interrupt them in the midst of this memorial. But that was done. And that was all December 21st, 2001, about a week ago, at the Homeless Services Center, 10 days ago. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is your Civil Rights on the Street show with Bathrobes Pierre Robert Norris here at 96.3. Call-in number is 427-3772. And we're soon going to be receiving a call from Wiley Drake, a Baptist preacher in Southern California who has been fighting for homeless civil rights for a long time. I'm going to read a few stories kind of as background before he calls in, to kind of set the stage. Here's a story from the July 9th Orange County Register in Orange County. City is prosecuting homeless woman. Some complain that Buena Park's approach to transients runs counter to many cities' aid-oriented tactics by Debbie Tallinan and Tiffany Montgomery, Orange County Register. An unusual case is unfolding in a North County courtroom between a homeless woman who refuses to leave town and a city government determined to enforce its anti-camping laws, even if it means throwing a 66-year-old woman in jail, which, of course, is what Ken Cole, the Homeless Services Center, did to Mary Curry earlier this year in March, when Mary Curry was removed from the Winter Sheltery Armory for trespass, recently unsuccessfully sued police officer Dan Brierley in a small claims court action. But we talked about that already. Advocates for the homeless say the prosecution in Buena Park is especially surprising because many police departments across the country are using a fresh approach with the homeless compared to the rush of arrests and court cases during a transient crackdown in the early 1990s. In this recent case, however, Buena Park officials are prosecuting Diane Grew, who appears to be the town's most permanent transient. Grew's jury trial is set to begin 8 a.m. today, this was in last summer, in courtroom N11 of the Orange County Superior Court, North Justice Center in Fullerton. Grew has slept in different parts of the city for about 4 years, usually with 2 to 6 other people, and has been ticketed for illegally camping 6 times. She has always pleaded guilty, sometimes paying a fine or spending up to a week in jail. Her current case took a turn when she failed last month to appear in court for trial, prompting a judge to issue a warrant for her arrest. Grew appeared in court Friday with her attorney and was released without posting bail. "Police keep telling me if you don't like it here, leave," Grew said recently, "but it's not going to be different anywhere else." Police have told her about local shelters, but she says she doesn't feel safe in those she has slept in Santa Ana and Buena Park. Those are suburbs of Los Angeles. So when her monthly $380 Social Security check runs out about the second week of each month, she leaves the motel she calls home and hits the streets. After her latest arrest in November near the railroad tracks, Buena Park City Attorney Gregory Palmer offered her 15 days in jail. But Grew said she was so terrified of being locked up for so long and decided to fight the charges. Her attorney is John Alexander, who represented Buena Park minister Wiley Drake in his battle to shelter the homeless at his first Southern Baptist church. In the Grew case, Alexander has accused the city of putting a human being in a cage for the sin of being poor. But city officials say they are simply enforcing a law that Grew refuses to obey. Most of the time, transients move on once officers inform them about the city's anti-camping rules, Police Captain Robert Cheney said. "Everyone else in the world seems to comply and sees the purpose behind these ordinances," he said. "There's this small group of people who chose to interpret the law differently and make the world think they're victims." Oh, I just love these police statements. Grew and her friends usually sleep in out-of-the-way places out of public view, but a few times a year, police conduct sweeps of homeless encampments at freeway underpasses and near railroad tracks to keep the population from taking root and growing, Cheney said. Otherwise, police only get involved when there are complaints. When police do cite transients, officers provide shelter information. But unlike some other agencies, such as the Costa Mesa Police and Orange County Sheriff's Department, Buena Park has not asked advocates for the homeless to line up mental health services, low-income housing, or job training to help Grew and the others in her condition. "Is it a police responsibility to try and put these resources in order for them?" Cheney asked. "Well, it may not be a police responsibility," said Karen Roper, homeless prevention coordinator for the county. She has been heartened that several law enforcement agencies have asked for her advice when facing homeless encampments. At large transient gatherings in Trabuco Canyon and Costa Mesa, Roper organized a team of nonprofits and other agencies to visit the settlement several times to get people connected to services after receiving calls from police. "The message I try to get out to law enforcement is, I'd love to assist them in addressing these issues," she said. Jim Palmer, president of the Orange County Rescue Mission, said he has also been thrilled with the change in police attitudes over the past several years. He has worked with the Sheriff's Department and Anaheim and Tustin Police, providing training for officers and helping them find resources for transients. I have to pause briefly to swallow my disbelief here. The kinds of resources available in all these towns, not by my direct calling recently, but generally speaking, has been very, very limited and nowhere near adequate. So it's misleading in the extreme to indicate that there are some resources available.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hey, this is Wiley.
Wiley Drake. You're the notorious pastor from Buena Park, California.
How are you?
I'm good. I hope I'm not interrupting your service down
there. No, we just finished our morning service. We finish about 12 o'clock, 12:15, depending on how long-winded I am.
Well, glad you finished in time.
Yeah.
I was just in the middle of reading an ancient story from July 9th, Orange County Register, about your old friend Diane Grew.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to read a little bit more of it aloud with you on the line and possibly get your comments.
Sure.
Because, I mean, what we've been reading about is how the police chief, Cheney, has been saying that I think his name is Cheney, isn't it?
No.
Robert Cheney?
There was a Richard T. Fink when it started, but in the process of that, they changed horses in the middle of the stream on us, and we ended up with a fellow by the name of Gary Hicken.
I see. Well, apparently at this point, there was a Captain Robert
There was an officer, Cheney.
And he's been saying that, they just conduct these sweeps once or twice a year, and all the rest of the people realize that they have to follow the law, but this woman is just so outrageous. And then the other service providers are saying, well, the strange thing about Buena Park is that they don't actually ask the service providers to come in and help with their mental health and low-income housing and job training shticks, as I call them, because none of these service providers have anywhere near adequate shelter in any of these jurisdictions for homeless people. It's merely a token effort which covers up police behavior, in my experience. Well, let me just read a little bit more and then get your comments here. Jim Palmer of the Orange County Rescue Mission says he's been thrilled with the change in police attitudes over the past several years. He has worked with the Sheriff's Department in Anaheim and Tustin Police, providing training for officers and helping them find resources for transients. Palmer wishes cities like Buena Park would spend as much time and money solving the problem as they do prosecuting the needy. Though anti-camping ordinances are fairly common in Orange County, Palmer and other advocates said they have not heard of any transients being prosecuted nor sent to jail in several years. Laura Weir, deputy director of Washington, D.C.-based National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty, said the usual penalties for violating camping ordinances, which 73% of the 49 largest American cities have on the books, are warnings and tickets. It's a little bit extreme to be prosecuting someone for that, she said. It seems that that's a poor use of resources. The money spent prosecuting her could be spent much better providing assistance. And I'm actually going to read the rest of this story later on after we've had our interview, because I know this is your dime here. Then, of course, there was a story on August 9th. Relatives surprised the defendant as evidence against her starts to crumble. This was a story by Debbie Talent.